ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 31st of March. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, good news for your back pocket. First, a petrol price cut. Now, card surcharges are set to go. And the sounds of Australia. What are the new additions to the National Sound Archive?
Doesn't that sound familiar? Doesn't that hit too close to home?
We debate, vigorous debate, about which sounds best kind of represent Australian identity and experience.
What is the charge? Eating a meal? A succulent Chinese meal?
United States officials have warned Iran there will be serious consequences if negotiations to end the war are not successful. President Donald Trump has threatened to blow up Iran's energy infrastructure if a deal is not reached shortly. It follows claims the US and Tehran are already in direct talks with one another over a peace deal, claims Iran's leaders have denied. Here's Kathleen O'Connor.
As Israelis endure more warnings of incoming Iranian missiles, US President Donald Trump issues a major threat to Iran, posting on social media, "If for any reason a deal is not shortly reached and the Hormuz Strait is not immediately open for business, we will conclude our lovely stay in Iran by blowing up and completely obliterating all of their electric generating plants, oil wells and Karg Island." Caroline Levitt is the White House press secretary.
Look, the president has made it quite clear to the Iranian regime their best move is to make a deal, or else the United States Armed Forces has capabilities beyond their wildest imagination, and the president is not afraid to use them.
Karg Island is a small island off the coast of Iran, which is home to a major oil terminal. It's considered the country's economic lifeline. Donald Trump claims he has deliberately not yet touched the island due to the impact it would have on the economy. Jen Parker is an adjunct professor with the Defence and Security Institute at the University of Western Australia.
It is where 90% of Iran's oil is exported from. They do have some ports outside of the Strait of Hormuz where they can export oil from, but they can't take the big deep-hulled tankers that Karg Island can.
She says although it's unlikely the US will strike Karg Island, it's not out of the question.
That would have a significant impact on both oil prices and oil flow. In fact, there's a number of ways to achieve the same effect without having such a dramatic impact on both oil globally, but also on Iran's economies. They could have a naval blockade in the Indian Ocean and start intercepting the Iranian oil tankers that are still going through the strait and seizing them. That is certainly what I would do. They could also look at putting sea mines around Karg Island or targeting some of the ships near Karg Island.
While the world suffers economic pain due to the war, US Secretary of State Marco Rubio says America still has some unfinished business. He spoke to Al Jazeera.
The destruction of their Air Force, which we've achieved, the destruction of their Navy, which we've largely achieved, the destruction of their factories, which we are well on our way to achieving, meaning factories that make these weapons, and significantly reducing the number of missile launchers that they have so they can't continue to threaten their neighbors and America. Those were our objectives. That's what we're focused on, and that's what we are well on our way towards achieving.
He says if Iran chooses to close the Strait of Hormuz after the military operation ends, there will be severe consequences.
One way or the other, it's going to be open.
US President Donald Trump has previously claimed to be in negotiations with the new Iranian regime over ending the war, saying he'd presented them with a 15-point plan. However, Iran has denied any direct talks are underway. Pakistan also offered to host peace talks between the two countries. At a press conference in Tehran, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Esmail Barayi responded to those claims.
The information conveyed to us under various titles, such as the 15-point plan, mainly include very excessive, unrealistic, and unreasonable demands. Our stance has been clear. Once we reach a conclusion, We'll announce it in an appropriate way because we're confident and we know what we want.
Meanwhile, political leaders in Australia and Britain maintain they will not provide boots on the ground in Iran and continue to call for de-escalation.
Kathleen O'Connor there. At home, the impacts of the government's decision to halve the fuel excise for 3 months won't be felt at the Bowser until this weekend, as petrol stations have to work through their current supplies first. The government says Australia's fuel supply remains secure into next month and rationing won't be considered until much further down the track. Here's Rachel Mealy.
When public transport isn't an option, tough decisions have to be made. With the cost of fuel soaring, farmer Jess Pluckrose is telling her kids they'll have to miss some extracurricular school events and sports training to keep the family budget on track.
At the moment, it has us questioning our every movement on the station. Like, what is essential, what can wait, and what is the most cost-effective way to get each job done? We didn't actually get to get our tanks filled on the station before the rain, so when trucks can finally get back in to top us up, the cost at current prices is going to be eye-watering.
The family runs a sheep and cattle farm on Marapina Station, 156 kilometres northeast of Broken Hill in New South Wales. That trip to Broken Hill can take up to 2.5 hours each way and uses a lot of fuel.
Like, we were going for the sport either 2 to 3 times a week, but yeah, we've already had to significantly reduce that, unfortunately. I mean, yeah.
Yesterday, National Cabinet announced measures to lower the fuel price for motorists at the Bowser. The excise cut will begin tomorrow and last until the end of June. It means the federal government will now collect 26.3 cents from every litre instead of 52.6 cents. The Prime Minister admits the measures may not make up for the price spikes caused by the war.
This is the biggest spike in petrol and diesel prices in history. That's what we're dealing with. I accept that it doesn't make up for the increase in price.
National Cabinet also agreed to a 4-step fuel security plan. Anthony Albanese says the country is at stage 2 and fuel rationing would only be used at stage 4 if there's an extraordinary disruption in supply. He wouldn't be drawn on what triggers the country moving to stage 3.
Our objective is to make sure that we do everything we can to keep supply, and we're doing that.
But Easter holidaymakers may not benefit from the government's moves to lower prices at the pump. Rowan Lee is the chief executive of the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association. He says the flow-on effect of the excise cut for Australians would depend on how quickly petrol stations sold their more expensive fuel.
So the petrol underground at your servo tomorrow will have the 52.6 cent per litre excise on it, and not until that stock is replaced will the lower excise price be applied. So that means for a high volume metro site, that could be a handful of days. For a more regional site, it could be a week or more.
David Leaney is an expert in supply chain management and a lecturer at the Australian National University.
I think the government's put a lot of measures in place already. We tend to ask, what's the government doing? We don't ask, what's the public doing? So I think there's some things like no containers, no jerry cans, certainly no 1,000 litre water tanks on the back of utes, which we've seen. Limits on purchase, prioritisation of diesel to farmers and regional areas, invoking the Liquid Fuel Emergency Act, and overruling some of that behaviour to stop people being able to panic buy.
Energy Minister Chris Bowen is continuing to urge Australians to exercise common sense.
Rachel Mealy. I'm Andy Park. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on ABC Listen. You can subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. It's the pesky fee nobody wants to pay. The Reserve Bank has now introduced reforms that will remove surcharges on FPOS, MasterCard and Visa cards from October this year. Here's what the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, had to say about the RBA's announcement.
We've made it really clear for some time now that people shouldn't be punished for using a credit or a debit card. And that's what this change will help deliver. Australians hate paying these charges. Let's be blunt about it. And so what these changes will do will give consumers more certainty and transparency about the total cost of goods and services when they pay by a card. and it will lower fees for businesses by about $910 million a year. And the Reserve Bank expects it to boost competition in the card payment market as well.
That's the Treasurer Jim Chalmers speaking this morning. The controversial reform was fiercely opposed by small business when first proposed. Business reporter Adelaide Miller joined me a short time ago.
So there's three main changes that are going to come into effect from October. The first one, and it's probably the most relevant to Australians, is the fact that we're no longer going to have surcharges on debit and credit cards. Essentially, the about 16% of businesses that do surcharge, it's going to have to be banned. And so when you look at the price of, say, food on the menu, that is going to be the final price that you end up paying at the cash register. The second thing is the interchange fees. It's basically what businesses pay to the card payment system to essentially monitor their transactions, to do business with them. And something that I think is worth noting is the small businesses are the ones who pay the most, because the big players like Woolies or Coles have so much bargaining power that they are paying smaller interchange fees. So there's now going to be a cap on those. And then the third element is all about transparency. So card payment providers, say FPOS, Visa, MasterCard, they're going to have to publicly disclose what each of their fees are.
I know consumers have been asking for these changes for the longest time. How long has the RBA been considering these reforms? How long have they been weighing them up?
It's been a pretty lengthy process, about 18 months from start to finish. And I mean, we're not actually at the finish line yet. There's still more to come. But within the 18 months, there were more than 250 written submissions from stakeholders and 150 meetings as well. And we're looking at some pretty big figures here. So, you know, nearly $2 billion with surcharges, nearly $1 billion with interchange fees. So there's going to be some pretty big disruption to businesses, but also stakeholders in general.
Meanwhile, the Fair Work Commission has issued its decision to abolish junior pay rates for young adult employees in the retail, fast food and pharmacy sectors while maintaining them for minors. What does this change mean?
It basically means that if you are aged between 18 and 20, you are going to be paid the same as, say, your colleague doing the same job. And I guess this is a pretty big deal in Australia now, because our young workers, who are very hard workers, are actually going to receive the pay that they deserve. They're doing the same hours, the same jobs as their colleagues, say, in their mid-20s, 30s or 40s. And so this really is an outcome that's about equity for our young workers. You know, they're paying tax, so they deserve to be paid properly. It's going to be something that's introduced over the next 4 years, with the first adjustments to begin in December of this year. But if you are under 16, you will still remain on that junior rate.
That's business reporter Adelaide Miller. Well, half of the social media platforms forced by the Australian government to block under 16s from holding an account are being investigated for non-compliance. It's the latest update from the eSafety Commission, showing Snapchat, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram and YouTube face millions of dollars in penalties if they fail to comply. The report has also revealed there's been no drop in reports of cyberbullying and image-based abuse since the ban came into effect late last year. Angus Randall reports.
In December, the world was supposed to change for Australian teenagers, but 3 months on, many under-16s are still able to access social media sites. Tony Fulfaro in eastern Melbourne says when the ban came in, his daughter's online life stayed the same.
It's pretty annoying because we were up when that came out, thinking that it'd give her a little bit of freedom from it. But they're all picking on each other and saying God knows what. She's had her ups and downs with it, and that's why we had to give her a time limit of a night time so she wouldn't go on it.
The latest update from the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, reveals 5 of the 10 platforms affected by the social media ban are under investigation for non-compliance.
Although we can see some progress has been made, it's clear there's still some way to go.
That possible non-compliance includes encouraging users to attempt age verification, even if their declared age is under 16, allowing children to repeatedly attempt age verification until they pass, and making it difficult for parents to report if their child still holds an account. Julie Inman-Grant says the investigations into Snapchat, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube should be finalised by the middle of the year.
And we remain committed to holding platforms accountable and ensuring that these protections deliver real change for Australian families.
But how Australia can hold these multinational giants accountable is unclear. The eSafety Commission says it can name and shame platforms that aren't doing enough and seek court-ordered civil penalties of nearly $50 million for those that fail to comply with the law. But what counts for compliance is still not locked into stone. Lisa Given is a professor of information sciences at RMIT.
The report talks about this being, you know, really relative. It depends on a lot of different contextual factors. And so the onus is going to be on the government to prove that the companies haven't taken reasonable steps, and that could well end up in the courts.
The eSafety Commission says 4.7 million accounts have been removed or restricted since December. But in a survey earlier this year, it found around 7 in 10 children still held an account on at least one social media platform. And in most cases, this was because the platform was yet to ask for verification.
We knew all along that this actually was going to be very difficult to actually implement and enforce. The government is now kind of doubling down and saying, you know, we're not going to settle for what we've seen so far.
Today's report also shows there's been no notable reduction in cyberbullying or image-based abuse of under-16s reported to the eSafety Commission since the ban. So if children continue to be harmed at the same rates as before the ban, is it making a difference? Professor Lisa Given says the social media ban is a positive shift, but it will never be a fix-all.
All this legislation did was keep kids from having an account. That means they can still look at content on other platforms through a browser, for example. They can look at YouTube videos. But also there were exclusions here. So messaging apps, gaming apps, and we do know that messaging apps in particular are often used for cyberbullying, sometimes by kids of the same age.
The eSafety Commission will release its next update in the middle of the year.
Angus Randall there. Experts on sovereign citizens say the police shooting of fugitive Desi Freeman yesterday could spark irrational conspiracy theories driving the group's behaviour. 7 months after he shot dead two police officers in the high country of northeast Victoria, Freeman was found on a property 100 kilometres away hiding in a shipping container. The possibility he had help to evade police over those 7 months has put the focus back on the sovereign citizen movement. David Sparks.
Victoria police have shot and killed fugitive gunman Desi Freeman.
It was over in a matter of hours. After 7 months in rugged high country, the elusive fugitive Desi Freeman was finally tracked down.
He was shot at a rural property in Victoria's northeast just after 8.
Freeman was found on an isolated property on the Murray River in Thalagalong, 300 kilometres northeast of Melbourne. He was part of the sovereign citizen movement, refusing to recognise the authority of governments, courts or police. And while he's now dead, the belief system that influenced him isn't.
We don't have a lot of data about the people who subscribe to this ideology, who engage in this behaviour. What we do know is that the drivers of the ideology haven't gone away.
Associate Professor Harry Hobbs from the University of New South Wales is an expert on the sovereign citizens movement.
So when people are facing personal crises or larger structural crises, they're feeling marginalised, they're feeling disempowered or alienated, that's when pseudo-law and sovereign citizen arguments, that's when it can be alluring. So those drivers haven't gone away, and so I imagine that we can expect that it's still around. It's become an enduring feature of our society at the moment.
Do we have any idea how the sovereign citizens movement has responded to the search for Desi Freeman and perhaps the capture and kill of Desi Freeman?
At the time when the alleged murders happened, we saw a number of people within the movement starting to fold in the deaths of the two police officers into their narrative of a conspiratorial state that has taken over and is removing our rights and liberties. And so we saw people, you know, under the guise of just asking questions, putting up videos online, discussing things on other social media sites about how this confirms what they've been saying all along, that the government is out to get us. I can imagine that the same sort of arguments have been folded into a new narrative around state corruption with this latest incident and the death of Desi Freeman.
Does the capture and killing of Desi Freeman strengthen or weaken the sovereign citizen movement, or neither?
I suppose the challenge is that the sovereign citizen movement or pseudo-law, it never works, right? And so at no point has any court said, you're right, your argument is correct, you don't need to pay rates, you don't need to pay tax, or you don't need to pay your mortgage. It has never worked ever. And so every time you lose, that just confirms your belief, right? And so in that sense, the killing of Desi Freeman yesterday may mean that some people think this confirms their views, and so they might go further into the rabbit hole.
And Associate Professor Hobbs argues the term sovereign citizen is problematic because it doesn't accurately describe the phenomenon and the people within it don't use the term.
Yeah, it's a name that we mainly give them, and I don't think the name necessarily works. The language that I use in my work is pseudo-law adherent. That kind of focuses on the behaviour and the attitudes and the performance of what the person is doing. So there's a number of different ways you cut it, but I think pseudo-law adherent is a broader and more accurate term in Australia.
Associate Professor Xanthi Mallett is a criminologist at the University of Newcastle. She says the movement has police and other authorities worried.
This is a rising movement and it is a growing type of ideology, and people are actually, you know, ascribing to this by joining groups from the US, for example. So it is a growing movement and authorities are watching very carefully because, you know, this could cause a lot of fear in communities.
Police in Victoria are continuing their investigation into Desi Freeman's movements over the past 7 months, and they're hunting for anyone who helped him along the way.
David Sparks. What is the sound of Australia? Well, the National Film and Sound Archive asked Australians to nominate sounds from at least 10 years ago that meant the most to them. And the 2026 Sounds of Australia capsule ranges from a joke song that captures our multicultural identity, that famous outburst about a succulent Chinese meal, to Rosie Batty's Moving Australian of the Year acceptance speech. Stephanie Smale has more.
It's a piano riff that needs no introduction, and it changed Australian pop when it hit the airwaves. Missy Higgins' 2004 career-launching song Scar is one of the 9 items in this year's Sounds of Australia capsule, adding to the collection held by the National Film and Sound Archive, where Megan Loder is the chief curator.
We're still talking about Missy Higgins and the album that came from won her so many ARIA awards in that year of its release. And Marsha Hines as well, an absolute titan of the Australian music industry, still on our screens today.
Marsha Hines' hit You made a splash nearly 30 years earlier, adding soul and confidence to the early Australian pop scene. To create the collection, Megan Loder says each year Australians suggest which iconic sounds they think should be included.
We actually go out to the Australian public and they nominate sound recordings that have really resonated with them. And it can be from anywhere from 10 years plus.
And a panel of experts makes the final call.
We debate, vigorous debate, about which sounds best kind of represent Australian identity and experience.
This is Democracy Manifest.
It's not just music that's been buzzing in our ears over time. Jack Carlson's rousing speech during his Brisbane arrest in 1991 has become one of the internet's most quoted Australian moments after it was uploaded to YouTube in 2009.
What is the charge? Eating a meal? A succulent Chinese meal?
Curator Megan Loder says sounds of the street have also been added.
We had so many nominations for this one. It really is the sound of Australian streets. It's our streetscape.
Australian history is documented in the 2026 Sounds of Australia Capsule 2.
The Federal Court of Australia is just about to begin.
In 2007, in a first for radio, the national title determination of Noonkanbah Station in Western Australia's Kimberley region was broadcast live, capturing the ruling and the reaction.
I regard it as appropriate that I should make the orders and the determination which are proposed.
There are school children surrounding Ernie Bridge under the marquee. Ernie's got his guitar.
From Murray Island wind.
And a speech that will never be forgotten. Rosie Batty's powerful words as she accepted the 2015 Australian of the Year Award, paying tribute to her son, who was murdered by his father, and vowing to make change.
Look around. Do not ignore what you see and what you know is wrong.
The sounds of the broader Australian community are represented in this year's capsule with jingles and jokes. 1-300-655-06. Megan Lotus says the Reading Writing Hotline jingle has made the cut after decades on the airwaves.
You know, that's a great way to access people who can't read is memory and sound. So it's got a really functional purpose.
And Joe Dolce's 1980 joke song that became an international hit, reflecting multicultural suburban life and working class humour. It's a nicer place, ah, shut up your face. There are now more than 200 recordings in the Sounds of Australia collection.
Stephanie Smale there, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Could the Iran war lead our economy into a recession? The answer is yes. Today, the ABC's finance expert, Alan Kohler, on why he thinks this could be one of the great disasters of our lifetime. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.